can get the exact same vaccine. Good point also about Johnson & Johnson. That vaccine would be a game changer if the phase three studies suggest that it's efficacious and safe to give to Americans. It's a single dose. There's not these issues about refrigeration, freezing, maintaining these vaccines under frozen conditions. And it does allow the more typical mindset of mass vaccination campaigns, because you don't need to have a relationship with the people who you vaccinate, and you don't need to follow up with them. You just need to give them that one dose. So hopefully we'll hear good news in the next couple of weeks on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and their commitment to supply approximately 12 million doses by the end of February.
And let's not forget, as the World Health Organization has pointed out, of the 46 countries that started vaccinating the populations, only one is low income. A future discussion tomorrow will be joined by Dr. Peter Salk, the son of Jonas Salk, the inventor of the polio vaccine. Dr. Ali Khan, thanks so much for being with us from Omaha, epidemiologist and dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, former director at CDC. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Dennis Moynihan. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31, 2021, at PCC's Cascade Campus, Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Inslee stakes out his third term, how he plans to fight the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Oregon teachers may return to in-person learning as soon as this month. And how unemployment during COVID is coming down harder on older women and people of color. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 14th, 2021. I'm Annette Newell. Voters just elected him to the Clackamas County Commission, but already calls are amplifying for the resignation of Mark Scholl. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade tracks the controversy.
A recently elected Clackamas County Commissioner is facing calls for his resignation after posting racist and anti-immigration content on social media. Commissioner Mark Scholl posted numerous statements criticizing Muslims, immigrants, transgender people, and the Black Lives Matter movement on his Facebook page from 2019 to 2020, with screenshots of the posts presented on a website documented by a community member surfacing this week. Chris Waller stumbled across the jarring posts and compiled them onto a webpage displaying them, saying, quote, "I happened to look at his Facebook page and my jaw dropped." Waller quickly documented the litany of hateful comments onto the webpage, fearing the newly elected official would delete them if word leaked out. Among the statements posted, Scholl equated Islam to radical terrorism, saying in a November 2019 post, quote, "The most menacing threat to the U.S. national security is the incursion of Islam into our society," end quote. Other xenophobic comments from Scholl condemned, quote, "new, belligerent, non-integrating immigrants as being a threat to society." News of the webpage created by Waller surfaced on Wednesday, leading to an uproar of calls for resignation coming from leaders in Clackamas County, Multnomah County, the Muslim civil rights organization CARE Oregon, and by Wednesday evening, the Portland City Council. Sehar Muranovic, a CARE Oregon board member, said on Wednesday, quote, "We are disappointed Commissioner Scholl cannot differentiate between valid information and conspiracy theories. Thus, we are calling on him to resign from office." In a statement to Pamphlet Media, Scholl apologized for the comments and emphasized that those thoughts are in the past, saying, quote, "I respect the freedom of religion that extends to the members of the Islamic community, as well as to all religious beliefs," end quote. That apology is falling on deaf ears as elected officials press forth, calling for Scholl's resignation. Multnomah County Commissioner Sushila Jayapal, who immigrated from India to the U.S. as a teenager before becoming a lawyer and an elected official, said, quote, "This is not an issue of questionable statement here or there. This is a history of expressing views that are abhorrent and antithetical to the values of this country and our state. Mr. Scholl should resign immediately," end quote. The entire Multnomah County Board of Commissioners joined with Jayapal calling for Scholl's resignation, with Portland City Council releasing a joint statement on Wednesday evening also calling for Scholl to resign immediately. Clackamas County is also pressuring Scholl to step down, with Commissioner Sonia Fisher directly calling out Scholl's comments as, quote, "deeply hurtful and racist and emblematic of today's politics of hate and division." Scholl was scheduled to be sworn in as commissioner on Wednesday, but the county says that date has been postponed due to threats of violence. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Oregon lawmakers will have to delay starting their work by at least 2 days. This comes after leaders canceled floor sessions and hearings because of warnings from police about violent protests. The 2021 legislative session will still officially start on January 19th, but the Senate and the House of Representatives will not meet in person. Senate President Peter Courtney from Salem tells the Statesman Journal, quote, "There's concern that they don't know quite what the level or the intensity of the demonstrations might be because of what's happened before to the Oregon Capitol and in D.C. During a special session in December, a mob against COVID-19 closures gained access to the building. Just yesterday, Jay Inslee made history as he officially started his new term as Washington's governor. He's now saying that public investments are key to his vision for the state's recovery from the COVID-19 crisis. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Jay Inslee was sworn in for his third term as Washington State governor and delivered his State of the State address on Wednesday. Inslee focused on the COVID-19 crisis and laid out a vision for an equitable recovery from the pandemic. Head of the Washington State Budget and Policy Center, Misha Werschkel, says the governor's proposed budget, released in December, outlines investments in public services and prioritizes racial equity. But her group sees it as just a start on the path toward an equitable recovery.
What I would say, though, is that in many cases, his budget doesn't go far enough to be able to really make that vision that he laid out a reality in the short term.
Inslee's budget, for instance, includes a one-time investment of $10 million into the Immigrant Worker Relief Fund. The Washington State Budget and Policy Center thinks lawmakers should invest in a permanent income support program for undocumented workers. The group also suggests the legislature invest more money in programs like housing and essential needs to improve access to affordable housing and prevent homelessness. However, the state faces a massive budget shortfall because of the pandemic, which is leading to calls for cuts. Werschkel notes that cuts did not bode well for states in the wake of the Great Recession.
If what we really want to do is get our economy back on track, the best way to do that is actually to have more public spending and investment in communities. That getting that money flowing is going to be what helps our economy long term.
Hers and other progressive groups are urging lawmakers to make the state's tax system more equitable. Washington's wealthiest residents have some of the lowest tax rates in the country. The governor spoke frankly about racial inequities in Washington state. Werschkel says the frank discussion will help the state prioritize communities of color.
I do think it's really important that both the governor and the legislature are talking about processes that are more equitable in terms of the development of the state budget.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Portland Public Schools reported this week that for some students, a return to in-person learning could come before the end of this month. After a school board meeting Tuesday night, plans to open classrooms in 16 elementary schools and 2 high schools are in the works. They're prioritizing younger students and those struggling with remote online performance. Chief of Schools Sean Bird says the partial reopenings plan for January 25th, with limits on attendance. Elementary schools with on-site childcare are taking priority. There will be a focus on kindergarten to third graders returning to in-person classroom learning for 2 hours a day while still maintaining at-home remote studies. The first groups in high schools to go back will be freshmen struggling with remote learning and juniors and seniors lagging in the credits they need for graduation. Groups returning to classrooms will top off at 13 to 15 students at a time to meet COVID-19 safety protocols. Next in line to go back in person will be middle school students, with emphasis on 6th grade level kids who underperform remotely in the first term of this school year. At Tuesday's meeting, Portland Public Schools did not release the names of the schools intended for the partial reopening, but they're planning for a second wave to open in February. PPS is saying they're looking at multiple factors for the opening of classroom doors, including the continuing spread of COVID-19, vaccination schedules, and teachers' willingness to return to in-person instruction. Current guidelines to bring students back into buildings include 164 mandated safety steps, such as 35 square feet of distance per student, maintaining 6 feet of distance from others, and for all participants to wear masks. Portland Public Schools schedules to reopen follow Governor Kate Brown's announcement on January 12th to begin the vaccinations of educators and those older than 65 on January 23rd. That's a month earlier than previously anticipated. The federal government announced an earlier release of vaccinations with new guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. About 130,000 people in Oregon have been diagnosed with COVID-19. The illness is linked to more than 1,700 deaths. Yesterday, a 19-year-old was one of 41 new deaths reported. The number of vaccinations in Oregon per day has now reached 7,000. That's not yet near Governor Kate Brown's goal of 12,000 per day. Oregon Live reports that Oregon has almost 200,000 unused COVID vaccines. It says Oregon's tracking system for them is riddled with errors and raises questions about the state's ability to efficiently get the shots into arms and closely track bottlenecks. Across the U.S., there have been more than 23.2 million COVID-19 cases and more than 386,000 deaths linked to it. President-elect Joe Biden will call for a $1.9 trillion plan to fight the pandemic, including funds for vaccine distribution and $1,400 per person payments to most households. Some groups are coming together to help older people get vaccinated. Suzanne Potter takes a look at one effort targeting California's older than 65 who are in the next tier of people eligible for COVID-19 vaccinations.
California has just changed its tier system to speed COVID-19 vaccinations for older people. The first tier of Phase 1 included people in nursing homes and frontline workers. Tier 1B has been expanded to include people age 65 and older, plus those who work in education, childcare, emergency services, and food and agriculture. Fred Buzo with AARP California commends the state for prioritizing older adults.
Since the start of the pandemic, nearly 95% of the deaths from COVID-19 have been among people who are 50 and over.
The state issues guidelines on each tier, but each county decides how to allocate them depending on the amount of vaccine they've received and the need in that area. People should check with their own health care provider and the county to determine when they will be eligible to receive a vaccination. Buzo says AARP's website now features a California vaccine distribution guide. In addition, there's an online hub for COVID information and a series of teletown halls about the virus.
Things are changing so quickly, so we are updating it very quickly. So you need to check back frequently.
He adds that people should be on the lookout for vaccine-related scams. In Santa Clara County, for example, Buzo says quite a few people have received fraudulent text messages telling them that appointments are available due to an excess of vaccine, when that is not the case. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Single-payer health care could cover all Americans and save $743 billion a year, according to a new report. As Eric Galatis reports, the Congressional Budget Office analysis shows it's possible to provide public health insurance to every person in the country while also saving money overall on health spending.
All Americans could have health coverage and costs would drop by as much as $743 billion per year if the U.S. switched to a single-payer health insurance system, according to a new Congressional Budget Office report. Matt Bruning with the People's Policy Project says the bulk of the savings would come from reduced administrative costs, which include private insurance companies' salaries and profits from 15 cents out of every dollar down to 1.5 cents.
Think about the insurance system as like a leaky pipe. You put money in it and about 15% of it leaks out and then the rest finds its way to the healthcare provider. So we can tighten that leak a little bit and save a lot of money.
The CBO projections also assume that the purchasing power of a single-payer system would help lower prescription drug costs and set universal payment rates for health providers, much as Medicare does today. Critics of single-payer proposals, including Medicare for All, warn that people may not want to go to medical school if they can't earn high salaries. Others have argued that pharmaceutical companies depend on high profit margins to produce groundbreaking new medicines. Brunig says similar systems in most of the world's developed countries have not deterred people from wanting to be doctors and nurses who still earn higher than average salaries. He agrees that surplus funds are necessary to develop new medicines, but says that money does not have to come through high drug prices.
For example, the National Institutes of Health fund a lot of drug research already. Sometimes it grants money to academic researchers. Sometimes it grants money to companies. R&D money's got to be there, but you don't have to pay 100 times what other countries paying for insulin.
Bruning adds that a single-payer system would not replace or take over hospitals and pharmacies and make healthcare decisions. It would simply reduce the number of companies that currently pay for healthcare from multiple insurers to just one. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report. We'll talk with State Senator Jeff Golden from Southern Oregon about priorities for what the state should be spending its money on. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, listen to the Soul Connection. Tonight's weather, we're likely to see some rain showers early, which will strengthen to more steady rain overnight. The low will head down to 44. Tomorrow's weather, showers in the morning, then partly cloudy by the afternoon, the high up to 51. And for the weekend, we're looking at partly cloudy skies Saturday, a better chance of rain Sunday, and highs near 50. Today in history, on this date in 1943, Franklin D. Roosevelt became the first president to travel on official business by airplane. He crossed the Atlantic in a Boeing 314 flying boat called the Dixie Clipper to a World War II strategy meeting with Winston Churchill. The quote of the day is from FDR, who said, "We must especially beware of that small group of selfish men who would clip the wings of the American eagle in order to feather their own nests." Donald Trump has now become the first American president to be impeached twice. 10 Republicans, including Southwest Washington State's Jamie Herrera Butler, joined Democrats in supporting his impeachment. The Senate trial probably will not start until after President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration next week. With more on the story, here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we track the transition in uncharted territory.
On this vote, the ayes are 232, the nays are 197. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
10 Republicans joined all Democrats voting to impeach President Donald Trump, including Liz Cheney of Wyoming, the number 3 House Republican. 197 voted against. This makes Trump the first American president to be impeached twice. Last year, not a single Republican voted for impeachment. Republican Representative Dan Newhouse from Washington State says the president took an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Last week, there was a domestic threat at the door of the Capitol, and he did nothing to stop it. That is why, with a heavy heart and clear resolve, I will vote yes on these articles of impeachment.
Senate Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell says he will not bring the Senate back into session for a trial before Biden's inauguration on January 20th. This impeachment, President Trump is charged with inciting the insurrection of the Capitol on January 6th. Democratic Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas described the danger lawmakers faced that day.
What do you think they would have done if they had gotten in? And who do you think sent them here? The most dangerous man to ever occupy the Oval Office. If inciting a deadly insurrection is not enough to get a president impeached, then what is?
Castro is also one of nine Democrats Pelosi named to lead the impeachment effort. All are lawyers with expertise in constitutional law, civil rights, and law enforcement. Lead trial manager is Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, a constitutional lawyer who drafted the impeachment article. Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the House Republican leader, voted against impeachment, saying it would further divide the country, a sentiment many House Republicans share. The counter is that Republicans who enable the divisive behavior of President Trump have no right to use this argument.
The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding. These facts require immediate action by President Trump. Accept his share of responsibility, quell the brewing unrest, and ensure President-elect Biden is able to successfully begin his term.
McCarthy blames Trump for the attack, but prefers censuring to impeachment. Federal intelligence officials warn of militia groups and racist extremists targeting the presidential inauguration on January 20th. During the impeachment hearing yesterday, the White House issued a statement from Trump, urging no more violence, lawbreaking, or vandalism. Quote, "That is not what I stand for, and it is not what America stands for," unquote. National Guards are already securing the Capitol. 20,000 are expected for Inauguration Day security in Washington, D.C. Airbnb and Hotel Tonight are also canceling all D.C. Metro reservations ahead of the inauguration. And Google is banning political ads till then. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
COVID-19 has been forcing women out of the workforce in record numbers. According to the United Nations and many other sources, the pandemic has hit women in particular hard, with massive job losses, shrinking economies, and the loss of livelihoods. Older women and women of color are seeing an even more brutal impact on their jobs and livelihoods. I recently spoke with an expert about why this is happening and what resources are available to help women get back on the job.
Susan Weinstock, I'm Vice President of Financial Resilience Programming at AARP.
Tell me a little bit about what are some of the folks going through in terms of, especially if they've lost jobs and they're trying to get back into the workforce during this pandemic. There's some extra challenges this time around.
Absolutely. You know, the unemployment rate is almost doubled since February of 2020, where, you know, pre-pandemic was about 3.5%. Now the unemployment rate is at 6.7%. For the 55-plus, it's 6% unemployment rate, which is more than double what it was also in February. Women, older women, well, all women, but women, older women are definitely feeling the pain from this as well. They have more than doubled their unemployment rate. And Black women have almost tripled their unemployment rate, older Black women, since February 2020. So this is hurting all demographics, all ages. It's really been a devastating blow for so many people.
Mm-hmm. Especially for somebody who's been out of work for months now, what are some of the things that could help them or strategies that might be beneficial at this point?
Right. Well, we know that, you know, of the 55 and older job seekers, half of them are long-term unemployed. That means they've been out of the workforce for 6 months or more, and that's really tough. One thing that they can be thinking about is reskilling and upskilling. This is a great opportunity to take a class or get a certification. So go to your local community college website. Look at the classes they have available. They're very affordable. Many are free, depending on your age. So look into that. There's also lots of online courses that you can look at to make sure that you're showing to prospective employers that you are a lifelong learner, that you're interested in continuing to remain relevant in your field, to build your skills. It's a great thing to be able to add to your resume, to add into your LinkedIn profile and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was told you had some state-specific information about Oregon and Washington. I was hoping you could relay that to us.
Well, in Oregon, I know that the unemployment rate has nearly doubled since the pandemic took hold. It's now at about 6%.
You said double? Is that right?
It's about double what it was, right, pre-pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is, this is quite a setback for, especially older workers who have been in the workforce for a long time. And will they ever be able to make up what they've lost?
Right. It's really it's hard to know. The lessons from the Great Recession are that older workers took double the time to find a new job than a younger worker. And even when they did, they ended up taking a pay cut from what their previous employment had been. So it can have a really hard financial impact on them when they have a shorter time to continue to save for retirement and ensure their financial security.
Mm-hmm. How can the new COVID relief bill help?
Well, it does include a $300 extra per week unemployment benefit. So that can be a lifeline for so many workers. So that's really important.
What would you tell unemployed workers they can do to improve their chances of getting a job?
Well, networking is huge. So most people don't realize that most people get their job through networking. So I know during this time it's hard to network, given that it's, you know, in pandemic, you can't just go get a cup of coffee with somebody, but use your social media contacts to do the networking. Make sure that LinkedIn profile is as filled out as possible, is as robust as possible. The more it's filled out, the higher up you're going to be in search. But also look at other people who might be of interest to you in finding your next job. And if they're linked to people who are linked to you, see if you can reach out and get an introduction. Send your resume. See if you can have a 5-minute telephone conversation. That's a great way to meet people to ensure so that when the economy is back up and running as it was before, then they'll remember you as the person who reached out and say, oh, we talked to that person. They would be great. Let's see if they can come in for an interview or offer them a job. So lay that groundwork now so that when the economy is back up and humming as it should be, you'll be the first person that they think of.
Is there anything else I haven't asked you?
Let me just mention our online career expo that's coming up on Thursday, January 28th. It's from 1 to 4 Eastern time. So this will be webinars. There'll be information about building your LinkedIn profile, about interviewing, networking opportunities. Employers will be participating. So lots of good information there. I definitely recommend if you go to aarp.org/online career expo, you can register there. And then the other resource I wanted to mention is aarp.org/work. We have a job board that is filled with jobs from employers who value older workers. We also have a resume tool. We will give you a free critique of your resume. We have lots of resources and information on aarp.org/work.
Okay. And how much does discrimination play a factor in, you know, you mentioned like the women in particular are hit harder.
Age discrimination is definitely a problem. When we've done previous research on this, about 2/3 of people said they've either seen or experienced age discrimination in the workforce. So it is really a problem, and that's why we've been fighting to combat age discrimination. We've been working with employers to teach them about the value of older workers. They understand that how important it is to keep that multi-generational workforce going, because we know that a multi-generational workforce is more productive, the employees are more engaged, and it lowers absenteeism, all things that any employer, you know, should want in a workforce.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your help today.
House Bill 113 would fine doctors as much as $50,000 for offering gender-affirming health care to minors. Another bill would affect transgender athletes in schools. Eric Tegedov has the latest on the two bills targeting transgender youth, which are already introduced in Montana.
Two bills restricting transgender youths are on the docket for Montana lawmakers this year. House Bill 112 would ban transgender athletes in public schools from participating in sports consistent with their gender. House Bill 113 would prohibit gender-affirming health care for minors, potentially fining doctors up to $50,000 for violating the statute. S.J. Howell with Montana Women Vote says these bills would harm young people. She says legislators should be focusing on COVID-19.
We think it's really, frankly, unconscionable that lawmakers are considering supporting this type of legislation, especially at a time like this.
Hearings for both bills were canceled this week and have not yet been rescheduled, according to the Montana Legislature website. Sponsor of the bill, Representative John Fuller, a Republican from Whitefish, did not respond to a request for comment. In an interview with Montana Free Press, Fuller says he opposes treatment that could have lasting effects on young people's bodies. All 130 members of the Montana chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics oppose HB 113. Vice President of the Montana chapter, Dr. Lauren Wilson, believes the bill is based in fear, not fact, and says knowing more about care for trans youth could reduce some of the stigma. For starters, therapy before puberty doesn't involve medication, instead focusing on letting a child express themselves how they choose.
At the onset of puberty, that comes a time for reevaluation with the patient and the family and decision-making together about maybe starting a puberty-suppressing medication called a blocker, which is completely reversible, but allows the patient and the family time to kind of assess where they are.
Wilson says trans youth have high rates of anxiety, depression, and suicidal thoughts because of the feeling that they're not in the right body. But she notes that rates go down if young people are affirmed, especially from an early age.
So that's good news. If we're allowed to provide appropriate care and the family is supportive of the patient, then sometimes there's really great outcomes for everyone.
A measure similar to the ban on trans athletes in school sports passed the Idaho legislature last year, but has been blocked by a federal court. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 14th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Eric Tegedoff, Eric Galatis, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us for the KBOO Evening News. And stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, coming up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
In December, the U.S. Congress voted to extend the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, or CARES Act. Besides supporting local governments, providing relief for small businesses, and distributing stimulus checks, the CARES Act carries three federal tax cuts for the nation's highest earners. Jeff Golden is an Oregon State Senator and host of the PBS series Infinite Possibilities. He's spearheading a bill to disconnect Oregon's tax code from these three provisions. Thanks for coming, Senator.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here, Ethan.
Why should Oregon exempt itself from these cuts?
Well, a little background first. You know, Oregon's tax code, like most states, is connected to the federal tax code. It copies what the feds do. So that's why if you fill out your own returns, you spend a whole lot of time on your federal return, and then the state return is easy, just a few minutes. And if we don't want to do exactly what the feds do, we have to do what's called disconnect by statute, by law. We have to disconnect from particular parts of the federal tax code and say, we don't want to do that in Oregon. And there are a number of times we've done that. There are a dozen or more ways in which we've disconnected in the past. So now these new three federal tax breaks that were part of the original CARES package almost a year ago are taking place, we either just kind of go along and don't do anything at all, in which case, starting next year, we will have a loss of revenue in Oregon of an estimated little north of $100 million that goes to these three new tax breaks, or we pass a law that disconnects, that says we're not doing these three tax breaks in Oregon. People can still claim them on their federal return, but not in Oregon. And I'm one of those who would like to do that, and then to take that $100+ million and direct it mostly, if not entirely, to small businesses, to businesses in Oregon that have been really hurt by the pandemic, possibly by wildfire as well. Because these bills, these tax breaks were promised to be aid to businesses who were really hurt by the pandemic federally. But that's just not true. When you do the analysis, really almost in all cases, it gets complex with the three breaks. But what you can say generally is that the great majority of it would go to the very highest income earners and the largest corporations, who by and large have not been hurt by COVID. And a bunch of us think it is sort of a cynical giveaway. And instead of the federal government designing how to relieve the pain of businesses in Oregon, we'd like to do that in Oregon and get it to those businesses, restaurants, bars, others, who are just hanging on by their fingernails right now. They're not going to get that relief unless we do this disconnect.
It sounds like these tax breaks are not just for COVID relief. The way I understand it, taxpayers affected by this bill can count losses as deductions as far back as 2018. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. And the thing about that is right now, the law before these new breaks says that this is one of the three new tax breaks. Basically, business losses, I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but they can be applied against personal income gains that are non-business. So dividends from stocks, capital gains, selling property. You can take your business losses and apply them against your income from other sources to reduce your tax liability. And right now, you can do that. Anybody can do that up to a limit of $250,000 if you're filing a sole return, or $500,000 if it's a joint return. What these breaks would do would lift that limit altogether. Say there's no limit to what you can decrease. Now, that's obviously not mom and pop businesses. That's obviously, very much larger enterprises and there are exceptions, but by and large, those are not the ones that have been hurt by COVID. It's our community-based businesses that are much smaller that need the help.
How have your colleagues, especially Senate Republicans, responded to your proposal to disconnect?
There hasn't been enough discussion yet. And what I'm trying to say, I find this really interesting, because there's sort of a knee-jerk belief that we're going to fight about this, that Democrats are going to like this disconnect, Republicans aren't. And maybe that's how it'll turn out. But I'm not so sure. Because just not long ago, I was on a Zoom call with a group and it included a couple of Republican legislators from my part of the state, House members. I'm in Southern Oregon. And they expressed a lot of concern. I think they're both from kind of tourist areas. And they expressed a lot of concern for their restaurant and bars, their small restaurant and bars, who in some cases have closed their doors and others are right close to it. And they said things like, so these folks are really suffering, and I noticed the large chain restaurants, they're doing just fine, and they've done fine through the whole pandemic, and they're not going anywhere. And those, businesses at those scales, those are ones that'll receive these new federal tax breaks. So I hear that, and I want to go to them and say, folks, this is exactly why we ought to disconnect, to get that relief to those smaller businesses instead of larger corporations. So, and I, in a couple conversations with Republicans, I've seen a bit of interest, but old habits die hard. And what we got to do is get this out of the template of, Democrats anti-business, Republicans pro-business. That was never quite true, but it's complete baloney today. So I'm trying to challenge that, general notion and say, look, we want to do business relief. We're agreed on that. Which way can we get the relief to the businesses that need it the most? And I'm hopeful maybe we could do some bipartisan work on this.
Tax breaks aside, do you feel that the CARES Act is doing enough to help Oregonians and Oregon businesses navigate the COVID-19 epidemic?
No, I don't. I think, you can say, well, the money got out. The first big thing was last March. I'm I'm not remembering the exact number. I think it was north of $2 trillion. And a total of, and I want to say $2.3 billion came to Oregon. And that was, did some really important things and supported a lot of people. And that was, you know, people were getting desperate. It was important. But when you, you know, Congress said, let's get this money out fast because people are hurting. And that's right. But when you do it fast, you do it, you don't do it as carefully, and you're kind of more at the bidding of the largest lobbyists, the K Street lobbyists. And I think a huge amount of this money went to where it wasn't needed. And it's not all about corporations. I mean, when you send out checks, I believe it was $1,200 checks to everybody who, you know, under a certain kind of high-ish income level, you are not, you know, you're getting, I'm sure, very welcome money to some upper middle class people, but you're not getting enough to, you know, people who may not have filed income taxes at all. So it didn't do the job. It wasn't surgical enough. And the K Street lobbyists have their fingers in it too. So, you know, the glass is partially full in that federal money got to some people who really needed it really fast. And there was a lot of fat to skim because it happened so fast.
Do you think that the companies that are most likely to benefit from these tax cuts play a fairly large role in Oregon state politics?
I can't answer that precisely. As a general matter, yes. I think they're, the corporate lobbies are very well represented in Salem. You know, when it comes to natural resources, I'm the incoming chair of the Senate Natural Resources and Wildfire Committee. And when it comes to natural resources protection, environmental protection, Oregon has fallen behind. You know, I came to this state 40 years ago, and we were Oregon-led in terms of in protecting the environment. And now when you compare us on most metrics to the other Northwest states, other states that are similar in natural resources and out of the Northwest, Colorado and others, we're not on the greener edge, we're on the browner edge. And the Oregonian and OPB and others have collaborated on feature stories in the last year about following the money of corporate contributions to actual policy. And I think it tells a pretty clear tale about the power of corporate lobbies in Oregon and about how hard it is to get on the table for serious discussion, real revenue reform.
Based on our discussion earlier, it sounds like a lot of members of the state Senate and the state Congress are becoming more responsive to the needs of small businesses that are really hurting. Do you feel optimistic looking towards the future that people are going to be learning from COVID-19 and adopting a more progressive tax reform?
I'm working on my optimism. I really am. You know, I want to, for years now, you know, I think there's a sort of a small minority of in the political sector and especially in the media sector who've worked hard to drive the wedge deeper between Republicans and Democrats. I mean, let's be clear, we have some genuine differences in philosophy, but kind of some of the screaming media and other forces keep pounding this message that we're so polarized and we can't get together. But I really think that, you know, as I say, it's been so interesting to listen to Republicans talk about their concern that small businesses are getting the shaft in their communities, or that may be strong, or the ones who are really suffering from the pandemic and aren't finding the relief, while major corporate business located far away from Oregon, headquartered far away from Oregon, is doing just fine. That makes me want to, you know, get us all in a room and go, what's a different way we could do this in terms of taxation that really supports the businesses in our communities we care about? And I'm optimistic that if we can kind of all take a deep breath and drop some of our old baggage, maybe we can come together on better consensus on all this.
Thanks so much for joining me today and answering my question, Senator.
Ethan, I enjoyed it. Thanks for asking me.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
Are people with disabilities being treated the same? A woman in Oregon had an unexpected interaction with her caregivers regarding her disability. When she went to the emergency room, the doctors questioned why she did not have a DNR or a do not resuscitate. So for those who are not familiar with this term, this essentially means that DNR is if should your heart stop beating, would you want aggressive or heroic measures taken? That's usually CPR or the chest compressions. So a do not resuscitate is an order that somebody puts into their chart that recommends that there should be no heroic measures taken should the heart stop beating.
Yeah, this raises more concerns about the elderly and disabled are treated during the pandemic. NPR investigated reports of discrimination in Oregon, such as denying COVID tests, pressuring family members or patients to sign DNRs, or denying equipment such as ventilators. The hospital denied any discrimination.
All right. Now, this story also provides us with another opportunity to recognize the discrimination that folks, in this case, people living with disabilities, can be confronted with in the healthcare system. Now, researchers have actually coined a term, disability paradox, to describe a situation where the provider will look at the patient differently from their family and friends. And sadly, this is sometimes combined with a difference in judgment on how quality of life is perceived. Doctors often hold biases toward people who can't be fully, quote unquote, cured, so to speak, right? So they won't use as much of the same effort compared to those they don't perceive as being disabled.
People with disabilities deserve more respect.
That's right.
Their disability is not what defines them.
That's right.
They're unique individuals, and it should go without saying, but apparently we need to say it.
Yeah.
And not only that is it wrong, but it's unethical. To deny any equitable treatment because of disability or assumed quality of life is wrong.
That's right, and we'll continue to follow this story.
Flu numbers are down as COVID-19 numbers rise.
We kind of predicted this.
We did. We hoped for it.
We hoped for it.
One silver lining from the pandemic is that the flu numbers are significantly lower than in previous years.
That's partly because of higher vaccination rates, which we definitely predicted.
Yeah.
And the Centers for Disease Control report that there have been a record number of influenza vaccines developed and distributed this year to avoid a twindemic. That's the combination of flu and COVID-19. In fact, flu vaccination rates amongst adults have risen 46% from 31 million in 2019 to 45 million this year.
That is a win on our part.
That's right. We called that.
We work really hard. And we're still, it's still, folks, please still get your flu shot.
That's right.
The record low number of flu cases can be attributed to higher vaccine rates in combination with the adoption of face masks, social distancing, school closures, stay-at-home orders, a lack of international travel, and Doc, you know, I've been saying it for years, wash your hands, wash your nasty hands.
And what do we do over the table here?
That was a fist bump.
So I think the elbow bumping and the fist bumping.
Another... Whatever works, acknowledgement without contact, we're all in.
That's right.
Many hospitals across the U.S. are nearing or are at capacity, but the lower rates of flu infection are helping to avoid additional pressures on the healthcare system.
Thankfully.
The resources that would normally be used to handle an influx of flu cases can now be used to handle COVID-19 patients instead.
Thankfully. Now, in addition to the flu vaccine, it is important to note that everyone needs to get the COVID-19 vaccine once it becomes available, even if you've already been infected with coronavirus. A person who has had the coronavirus likely has had some level of immunity, but immunologists and vaccine experts say that these individuals should get vaccinated immediately when a vaccine becomes available to them, because we don't know what the viral dose or the infectious dose was when a person was infected with COVID-19. If it was a low infectious dose, you may have launched a low immune response, which makes you susceptible to another round of COVID-19, even though that's a rare thing. But even still, we need to give everybody a vaccine, even if you've had it before in the past. So this way, you've had a standardized dose of the vaccine so that you will get a standardized immune response, Doc?
Yep. Get your shot. The biggest reason why they should is because different immune systems have responded differently to the virus. One immunologist at La Jolla Institute for Immunology says that a body will mount a durable immune response that could last for up to 8 months. But that's only the case for 90% of the people.
Doctors have no way to tell who will be in that 90% or the 10% of people without a lasting immune response. So not continuing to use precautions like wearing masks and social distancing after being infected means taking a big risk that you won't be infected again. So what we're saying is that you still need to wear masks
and social distance after you've been vaccinated. Wash your hands and stay away from sick people. Getting the vaccine helps to level the playing field. People whose immune systems didn't produce a robust and lasting response to the first infection can catch up to those who didn't by getting the vaccine.
Because we have no idea what our individual body's immune response to coronavirus will be. And it's important to do everything we can to give ourselves the best chance to avoid infection or even so reinfection. So get vaccinated.
Get vaccinated.
And then wear a mask.
And wash your hands.
And social distance.
And check your figure moving.
Hi, I'm Hope, one of the writers for the Noise Filter podcast. Like many of you listening, I have had a loved one contract coronavirus and have a rough time of it. It's an experience I wish none of us had to go through. As we continue on with this pandemic, it's important to recognize that this virus affects everyone, not just the person that's infected. So over the next couple of weeks, you will hear firsthand accounts from the caregivers of people that have been infected with coronavirus. I hope that you hear their stories and do everything you can not to put your loved ones through the same thing. So joining us today is Brandon. Thanks for taking the time to do this with me, Brandon.
Oh, no problem. I hope I give you what you need.
So let's just start at the beginning. Who was the person that contracted coronavirus in your life?
It was my wife, Danielle.
Okay. And you served as caregiver for her?
I did, yes.
Okay, so let's just go all the way back to the beginning. How did the conversation go when she told you that she tested positive for the virus?
So she just started feeling kind of weird. And my wife, just to give you a little bit more background, she has asthma. So we were always very concerned that if anyone in the house got it, we definitely didn't want her to get it because of her pre-existing condition. And so she started to feel a little bad, but it hit all the boxes of what we knew COVID was at the point. And she wasn't having a lot of symptoms. She might, you know, her head was hurting here and there, but nothing too bad. Like I said, dealing with asthma, she's used to having some issues with breathing or coughing or things like that. So we just kind of swept it under the rug of just dealing with the asthma. And then almost like 5 days went by. And when she got her results as positive, it really kind of threw everyone into a panic because it's like, okay, we've been around each other all week in the house. Who else is infected? So the first thing we did was load it up, myself and my two kids in the car, and went to Lamar Dixon and got tested ourselves.
Wow. That's a lot. I can only imagine how that made you feel. So tell me, how did it make you feel when you realized, wow, she's positive? And I'm assuming that you and your kids were negative.
Yes. At first, it's kind of like trying to figure out, how did this happen? How did we not know it was happening? And how did we not prepare for the possibility of it being positive? Like, we've been taking so many precautions, and it's like, how did this happen? So you just go through a rambling in your head of, how did this happen? What do we do next? How does this affect the kids? How does it affect me? You know, who's going to take care of who if we all got it? How do we balance this? How do we make life continue to happen while we're dealing with somebody that's in our home and our presence positive? Everything that we knew as a normal day, normal life, got flipped on its head, and we just kind of had to make it happen. Every minute could not be planned. We had to literally fly by the seats of our pants of what was going to happen next.
And that was going to be my next question. What adjustments did you have to make in your life? And it sounded like you had to make a lot of adjustments since she was the main one at home with the children while you were working. So you really had to flip everything upside down to make it work while she was in the middle of it, huh?
We did, but she still felt inclined to do some things, and, you know, feeling like she had to help with lunch, feeling like she had to do something with dinner. And right now we're living with my sister-in-law, and so she was able to assist with some of the things with the kids and some of the cooking, lunch or dinner. But for the most part, it just became to a point where, like, normally we might talk about what we're going to do for dinner the next day or the next couple of days, and it came like today. You know, what can we do that's easy, that's fast, that's quick? Because, you know, neither one of us are cooks, but my wife is the main cook in the home. So it became like, okay, so how do we get through these days? Because it's like COVID is supposed to only last a couple of weeks. All you can think about is, okay, this day she still has it, how do we function? This day, the next day, she still has it, how do we function? And the fact that she had asthma, Mike, she still has residual effects from having COVID. She's been to the hospital 3 times since COVID was over for her, dealing with her breathing. So it's just like, even when it was over, it wasn't over.
So it sounds like you lost a little bit of your peace inside your home with all this.
That is an understatement. Mm-hmm. It went from just getting through the day with kids and those stressors with, you know, them being in school to, let's just get through the next 5-10 minutes. Let's get through the next 30 minutes, the next hour. How do we sleep? How do we function? You know, quarantining her and still making sure that we're getting enough rest to get through the next day. Mm-hmm. So it just, peace was not a point of concern as much as it was keeping her healthy and keeping her functioning as much as she possibly could so we can all function. Because as most people know, as the mom goes, how that's pretty much how the house goes. And when she goes down, it's just stuff don't function like it normally does.
Yeah. Sounds like there was a lot of changes, a lot of ups and downs. But emotionally, Brandon, like how was all this making you feel? Especially now you told me that even when it was over, it wasn't over. So like, how are you feeling?
To be honest with you, when it first happened, I was frustrated because, like I said, my wife is the germaphobe, and it's like she's the one that gets it. It's like, how did this happen? Like, I should have been the one to get it because I'm not doing everything she's doing or kind of giving her pushback on it. And so it's like, how did it happen to you of all people?
Mm-hmm.
You really go through an emotional roller coaster.
Yeah, I get it. So did you have a support system, anybody that you could talk to just like get it out?
Well, my family called on a consistent basis, just checking on her. So, you know, it just becomes, everybody kind of has to pull together. I felt the support, you know, I didn't feel like I was doing it by myself. But yeah, the support was great as far as, you know, who can I talk to? You know, my dad, my sister, my mom, just talking to my wife, just trying to figure out what she needs in the moment. Cause that was up and down. Sometimes she'll feel okay enough to get up and do something, masked up, or it's like, I just can't right now. And so just trying to figure out how to support her.
And so what would you tell anyone that's listening now?
Oh, Lord. For anybody taking care of anyone with COVID, I would just say, hopefully for you, if you're able to keep them in the home to the point where they're not having to be admitted, it's a blessing. You really have to count your small blessings in these moments. We've heard too many stories of people going to the hospital, not coming back. People going to the hospital
and having to tell their loved ones goodbye over the nurse's FaceTime. And so you really have to take it moment to moment and take the small win. A 5-minute period where breathing is okay and the fever breaks, or just whatever you can take as a small win moment to moment, because this virus is so crazy. Don't make yourself the victim as they are going through their situation. You know, you have to take yourself out of the equation in the sense of, I'm not the one positive. Because if you don't, you're going to put more strain on them to take care of themselves. And that's just not fair to me, in my personal opinion.
Understand what you're saying. But Brandon, as a caregiver, your role is just as important and you deserve to be taken care of as well, you know?
Thank you.
Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time, where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at NoiseFilter on Instagram, NoiseFilterNola on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to NoiseFilterShow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
This is KBOO in Portland. I'm Raj Patel, and you're listening to the only radio station named after a kind of marijuana.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information